Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
The section that we're looking at today, the Shelach, and it is, you might say, quite a sobering part, especially when you see that the section there at the end of chapter 14 talking about the rejection of the land. You can really hear a lot of the sadness in there from the sake of the people, but also from the sake of the Lord. I'm going to be getting into more of that. And then you also see the sobering aspect of the part that we just read about the Shabbat. And you're like, wow, you know, it seems to be kind of a break from what you see in Isaiah chapter 58, where it says, you shall call the Shabbat a delight. And here it carries the gravity of the capital offense. So let's take a look at kind of from a high view of this before we start looking at some of these really important lessons in detail. And as it's noted here on the screen, and for those of you who can't quite see it, if you want to go into greater depth into what we're talking about today, because we're going to hit some high points of sections that we've talked in previous times through this passage, just go to hallel.info/P37, because this is the 37th parasha going through the annual cycle. So hallel.info/P37 if you want to see some of the previous studies that we've hit on. But like, for example, we're going to touch on Joshua chapter 2 just briefly today because we've talked about it in great detail in times past. But some of the highlights we're looking at here. First of which, that really our forefathers in the Commonwealth of Israel had to learn faith. You know, when we were going through, the section on looking at Avraham, we saw that he had to learn faith, and we see here also that they had to learn faith about how to conquer their foes. And we also see that that kind of faith is what Yeshua the Mashiach's sent ones, his apostles. We'll be getting into that term there. But the topic of this passage is called Shelach, or send. So you could say the noun form of that, those people who are sent, are called a Shelach in singular, or a Shelachim for plural. So they had to learn also trust, and they had to learn that during Yeshua's earthly ministry here, but also when he returned to heaven, especially. So one of the things that we'll see is that there are a number of parallels, not only in similar language, the way it's structured, but also in some of the themes between Moshe's sending out of the 12 spies and Yeshua's sending out of the 12 apostles. And we'll see it's expanded even to 70 at one point to the lost sheep of Israel. And one of the lessons that we get from the Haftarah, or the parallel passage to Shelach in Joshua chapter 2, is really another foreshadowing. So the sending of the two spies there after this 40-year period. So we're jumping ahead 40 years after the wandering into where that second generation is going to be entering the land, that they spy out Jericho, and you come across Rahab, or Rahab, and we see there a picture of something that you could see started with the coming of the mixed multitude out of Mitzrayim, in that there was a calling of all nations, just not one clique, special group in Israel, but this was a message that would be for all nations, just like we saw back in Exodus 19, where it was talking about at the mountain that he would be a kingdom of priests. a kingdom of priests to the world, not just some selective club, but this would be a message going to the whole world. And one of the other messages that we see really in this is, as we talked about through the book of Vayikra or Leviticus, that this has to do with what's happening inside of you, the inner character of a person. So a message that we have, that we get from Yehoshua and Caleb, is that we go where the Creator sends us. And similar to what the judge prophet Shemuel said there at the beginning of his life when he was called while he was serving. Now, we talked earlier about the Nazir, or the special dedicated servant in there, and you could almost say that he had dedicated his life there living as a priesthood into serving the tabernacle, because his service was a life service, as not only being, you know, connected to the house of God, but also being a prophet to be speaking for. So in a sense, filling a bit of the calling of a shalach, or a delegate from heaven. And we'll see that particular aspect of where Shemuel said, "Here I am, Lord, send me," that you see that also echoed in Isaiah chapter 6. And something very interesting message that's touched on in the Gospels coming from Isaiah chapter 6. So, all that said, diving into our first section here in Numbers chapters 13 and 14. So we've got the two good reports from Caleb and Yehoshua, and then the 10 bad reports about the land. And we say that they were swayed by these false reports, and Israel rebels, follows the testimony of those folk, and rebel against where the Lord is leading them. And then Moshe intercedes. So the theme of Numbers chapters 13 and 14. Now, the interesting point about this, about the two good reports and then the 10 bad reports. So if you're looking at today we always look at the ratings of things and how many ratings are good, how many ratings are bad. So as we've mentioned in previous years, that you really have to judge a message by the message and not just by the quantities of messages, because that is one of the logical fallacies out there, is just because a lot of people say it, that means it's true. And you'll hear people say, well, if what you're saying is true, why wouldn't a lot of other people say it, especially a lot of important people? Why wouldn't they also say it as well? You have to evaluate things based on what it is, not how many people or how many important people say, because this is a prime example of it, of bearing false witness, that this witness, you could say two of these great leaders, the apostles of the 12 tribes, they were sent in. Two of them saw, hey, this is what the Lord said it would be, but also it was that the Lord had given this to us, even though you have giants, even though you've got big walls, no problem. We've got this, because the Lord is going to be with us. 10, we're saying, saw a lot of the same testimony and came to a completely different conclusion. So be careful just by how many people are bringing a message forward. Is it true? Is it not true? We have to really look and search it out, because these 12 were presented with the same, quote, evidence of the land, and they then reported to the tribes they came from this, quote, evidence, but with a spin. Now, when you say spin, we always think, oh, spin is a bad thing. Well, everybody spins everything. I say that as a journalist, everybody spins everything. So nobody is never, that's a double negative. Boy, my grammarian teachers would shoot me on that, but nobody is never spinning anything, which means everybody's always spinning everything. It just depends on your perspective. Now, there is good bias and there is bad bias. And the question is what is the bias? And is it pointing you towards something that is good or something that is bad? So, with all that said, we have the Moshe sending out the spies, and he picks these 12 spies from the 12 tribes. And these each were called a Nasi. Now, we had seen earlier in Numbers, they were talking about the Nasi of every tribe and in groups of families within them. Each had their leader. Now, these were also called leaders, and we'll be getting into a little bit more of that later, but we'll see that there is a sense that these are, you could say, stand up men of substance within their tribes. So this is also a good lesson of the people that you want to appoint to head you up. Character matters, because if they are not of the right character, then you might see that they will be leading you in the totally wrong direction. So by popular vote, the following the Lord's leading into the land, that was not seen as, that went down, you know, 80-20. So 80 voted against it, 20 were only going for it. So if you were to say, oh, 80% opposed this, wow, that's a bad poll reading. But as we'll see here, there's a parallel to this in Matthew chapter 10. So we'll drop in here next to see where Yeshua is picking the 12 and also sending them out. So we'll be back to Numbers here soon, but we'll be taking a look here into Matthew chapter 10. So Matthew chapter 10. Yeshua summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Now the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Shimon, who is called Kepha, Andrew's brother, Yaakov, the son of Zebedee, Yochanan, his brother, Philip, and Bartholomew, Thomas, and Matthias, the tax collector, Yaakov, the son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Shimon the Zealot, and Yehuda Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. These 12 Yeshua sent out after instructing them, do not go in the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter any city of the Samaritans, but rather go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out the demons, freely received, freely give. Do not acquire gold or silver or copper for your money belts or a bag for your journey, even two coats or sandals or a staff, for the worker is worthy of his support. In whatever city or village you enter, inquire who's worthy in it and stay at that house until you leave that city. As you enter the house, give it your blessing. If the house is worthy, give it your blessing of peace. But if it is not worthy, take back your blessing of peace. Whoever does not receive you, nor heed your words as you go out of that house or that city, shake off the dust of your feet. Truly I say to you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. But beware of them, for they will hand you over to the courts and scourge you in their synagogues. And you will even be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them and to the nations. But when they hand you over, do not worry about how or what you are to say, for it will be given you in that hour what you are to say. For it is not you who speak, but it is the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all because of my name, but it is the one who has endured to the end who will be saved. But whenever they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. For truly I say to you, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he become like his teacher, and a slave like his master. If they call the head of the house Beelzebul, how much more will they malign the members of his household? Therefore, do not fear, for there is nothing concealed that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be made known. What I tell you in the darkness, speak in the light, and what you whispered in your ear, proclaim on the rooftops. Do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a cent? And yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. But the very hairs on your head are all numbered. So do not fear, you are more valuable than many sparrows. Therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think I came to bring peace on this earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be members of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross to follow after me is not worthy of me. And he who has found his life will lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake will find it. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward, and he who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever in the name of a disciple gives to one of these little ones even a cup of cold water to drink, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward. So what we see here at the beginning of this chapter, we see bit of a name change, or at least a job title change, that not only just called disciples, which is in verse 1 of chapter 10, Matthew, but then apostles in verse 2. So, disciple, kind of looking under the hood of the original language here, disciple is from mathetes, and mathetes is similar to the Hebrew form of Talmud, which is where you get called the Talmud, which just means, student. So that idea of a student, who are you a student of? And apostle, from apostolos, and apostolos is similar to shaliach, which means delegate. And shaliach is the noun form of shalach, which is what we're looking at in our passage back in Numbers today. So we see also combined with this passage and what you see in Acts chapter 1 when they go to replace Yehuda Iscariot after he had betrayed the Mashiach and then committed suicide, they looked to replace him. And one of the requirements for who they would consider is that they were considering witnesses of his words, deeds, death, and resurrection. So these ones were not only students of the Mashiach, but also delegated. They had a delegated task to go out, an ambassador role, which gets into why the Apostle Paul talks about the believers being ambassadors for the Mashiach, because we're sent out with not only a mission, but to represent. The old adage of, well, truth hurts, I'm just going to lay it all out here and who cares what happens or how I bring it out as long as the truth gets out. Well, also look at how you're representing the kingdom of God in the process. Are you represented accurately or not? as we'll get to see later on in the passage from the prophet Yeshayahu, is that not every true message has to be mamby-pamby or delicate in the way it's presented, but also we have to take very great care in how we present it. Are we presenting it with more teeth than it needs? Some messages need teeth, but wow, we have to take care in how and when we're bearing teeth for the kingdom of God. So, getting back to our passage there in Numbers chapter 13, one of the things you saw in that passage there was that the Lord rewarded the faith of Caleb and Joshua by promising that they would enter the land and giving them Hebron to Caleb. You see that recorded in the recounting in the first chapter of Deuteronomy as Moshe is telling the second generation that is getting ready to enter the land. So the children of who were talked to there very harshly in Numbers chapter 14, so the second generation is getting a recap of what happened about four decades earlier. And in that, it's noted that for their faith, the faith of Caleb and Yehoshua, that when the Lord said the land was going to be given to them, that the Lord would actually give them the land, that faith was rewarded with a specific giving of Hebron in there. And you see later on that the Anakim, or the cities that really frightened the other 10 spies, were also among the first to fall to Yehoshua and Caleb. There's recorded in Joshua chapter 11 and Joshua chapter 14. So we see, yeah, the old adage goes, so the mightier they are, the harder they fall. Well, when you're talking about the power of the creator of heaven and earth, yeah, mighty they appear, how tall they are, how very strong they are, how thick the walls are, doesn't really matter when you see the power of the Lord in action. So, comparing that back to Matthew chapter 10, to Yeshua's sent ones, his apostles, you see that Yeshua sent out his 12 special. These are, we talked about the Nasi, the special Nasi of the 12 tribes that were sent out into the land. Well, now here in Matthew chapter 10, you have these special Nasi of Israel. And as we know about their backgrounds, they were picked from all different types of places. And the case is, when you're thinking of character, think about the character of the 12. Some of them may not have looked like much from the outset, but then they became great pillars later. And you even see, like with the apostle Kepha or Peter, that even he looked like he was maybe not the most trustworthy, you know, denying him, being quite rash and brash with his proclamations and actions. But he became a rock of the faithful later on. And one thing to note here in Luke chapter 10, the parallel passage to this, is that the sent ones, Yeshua then had a sent ones that sent them out, and 70 or more that were gathered together. So, as we've seen in previous occasions with the idea of 70 being a representation and thought to represent all of, or the totality of the nations, because remember, seven being given or connected to the idea of an oath. So, with that, you have a bit of a surety of it. So, with the 70 is a picture of the totality of the world. Interesting foreshadowing there of the things that were to come. Now, just a little bit of a note here that about the interesting thing of Yeshua sending out his 12 apostles in teams of two. Now, there's some over the centuries, some Jewish writers have noted that the Hebrew of Numbers 13 1 has a strange sort of doubled one man phrase. It says, you know, Ishachad, Ishachad, and it goes on. And so that's created some interesting ways that people have rendered that phrase there, Ishachad, Ishachad, in different translations. For example, the King James Version says, a man, everyone from a tribe. And the New American Standard Bible has rendered like a man, and then later on, you know, each one kind of referring to a tribe. The Septuagint just took this and reframed it to more clearly say a man, each one from a tribe. So that's where you kind of get this picture of when it's the reading is there in English and even in, you know, the Greek translation in the Septuagint, that you have this picture of one man, one tribe. But some are thinking, well, maybe one thing being communicated is Ishachad, Ishachad, is also referring to maybe two at a time. Because that gets in the picture of number one, with Caleb and Yehoshua being mentioned together, kind of team faith, so to speak, later on. And also they mentioned that, well, there's the one that went, the one group that went to the Valley of Eshcol for the cluster of grapes that they're carrying between two of them. So maybe it was a pair of people, who knows? But that's an interesting idea, the parallel between what we see in Numbers chapter 13 and also Matthew chapter 10 of going in pairs. And you see that also, you know, you can take different ideas of what you want, but going out in pairs, and we see it later on with, you know, Paul and Barnabas and Paul and Silas, that the idea of a team is also helpful in, you could say, accountability to each other, also strengthening each other when times get tough. And some missionary organizations, they like to pair people together, one who's more experienced, one who's less experienced, to number one, to keep the more experienced one, you could say, with the eye toward what a quote newbie would see, or things that he may have glossed over time, or think that it's already understood. Well, someone maybe newer can see something different, and also to train the next generation as they come up. Now, one of the other things that some have seen in thinking, well, if they were really teamed two by two, well, why is then in this list that we read earlier in Numbers chapter 13, is there the one in between of Yigal, the son of Yosef, between Caleb and Yehoshua in the list? So some have thought, well, hey, Yigal actually, could be translated as he saves, or if you just change one vowel, it would say will save. So the idea of, you could translate it as the will save, or the he saves son of Yosef. And the picture there is that son of Yosef in later Jewish literature seen as the bifurcation of the Mashiach into the Mashiach son of Yosef and the Mashiach, son of David. So you got the son of David as being the conquering king, and the son of Yosef being the suffering servant, like Yosef when he was suffering in his early years in Mitzrayim after his brothers sold him into slavery. So, yeah, kind of an interesting little point there, that maybe another aspect, a teaching of the connection between what you see there in Numbers and also what you see there in Matthew chapter 10 of the pairing between them as being a part of the Messianic age. So something else to think about with some of the instructions that we saw that were given there in Matthew chapter 10 and kind of recapped briefly in Mark chapter 6 in a parallel passage, but the dominate the strongholds over unclean spirits, demonstrate the power of heaven, and anoint the sick to heal them. As it's mentioned there in Matthew 10:8, freely have you received, freely give. To depend upon the provision of heaven, work of the Spirit in the hearts of the hearers. Now, don't take extra provisions. Well, what does that sort of sound like? Remember the idea of the land full of milk and honey and that aforementioned aspect of the giant cluster of grapes? Now, one of the things you see in later rabbinical literature, kind of in the intertestamental period, and even in later in medieval times, is that this picture of the Messianic age is where, you just have so much abundance, where they talk about one cluster of grapes can fill 10,000 cups. The picture that there will not be any lack of provision. So this picture here of where Yeshua is sending them out saying, hey, the work of heaven will be taken care of. And it's a very interesting also aspect of the idea of giving a blessing upon a home, giving your shalom, taking it back. We talked about that in previous studies, but this idea of shaking the dust off your feet and the picture of it would be better for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment. Well, why? Is it just because you're not giving a blessing? Well, who are these 12, in this case, in Matthew chapter 10, going to? The lost sheep of Israel. Well, in this case, you're dealing with the attitude of sheep that may not want to be found, or they may not want to be found by that particular shepherd. You have to remember that going back in the period of the intertestamental period, where like the prophet Yirmiyahu talks about that there are these bad shepherds. There's the good shepherd, the quintessential picture of the Mashiach, but also there are a lot of bad shepherds that are leading the flock of Israel astray. So when the Mashiach comes, then the Mashiach has to do a lot of herding of the sheep to bring them all back in to the one sheep pen. But as Yeshua said in another occasion, the sheep hear my voice. And you'll see that when the Mashiach's message, the message of heaven, goes out, people understand that that is what it is. So, kind of going back to Numbers chapter 13 again, and the picture of these Numbers 13, 14, where the spies come back. So, are the sheep of Israel able to actually hear the message of heaven? One of the things that's been debated by commentators over a long period of time is that this whole situation of why send out the spies to begin with, because is that doubting the provision of God, that God was able to take it? Is this setting Israel up for failure, kind of like putting the tree of knowledge of good and bad there in the garden to create a problem? They say, well, also what Paul gets at is with the law being given because of transgression, is that just setting people up for failure of it? Or where we're getting at with the beginning of this, is this all about trusting the Lord and where the Lord is leading? We see in the garden, the issue was trust. Where are you going to go for the knowledge of good and bad? Are you going to go to a tree or some, in other words, some other source other than the Creator, or go to the Creator? In this sense here in the land, are you going to trust the one who took you out of the house of bondage and took you into the land? Or are you going to think, oh, we got here, we can't handle it, so we're toast? So, really, the question was for that generation, just like it was for the generation there that was thinking about going into the land, as recorded there in Matthew chapter 10, verse 7, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Do you actually believe that the kingdom of heaven is at hand, or that it's here, that it's coming with power? Or do you say, it looks like it's too weak? These two guys came into our village, they don't seem like they're educated, they don't seem like they've gone to the good schools, they're telling us that the Mashiach is here. Is the kingdom of heaven really here, or are they just trying to sell me a bill of goods? Similar thing is You know, you've got 10 of the spies that are saying, we can't do this. We're toast. Two of the spies go into the land and says, it doesn't matter how big the walls are. Our God is bigger than the walls. Our God is bigger than the giants. Our God made the giants and made what the walls were created out of. So who is greater in the grand scheme of things? So just a brief recap of Joshua chapter 2, because we've covered this on previous occasions, but just in the little bit of the context of it, the story of the two spies going into the land, just hitting on the note here about Rahab. And Rahab, these two spies that go to Rahab's house there in Jericho. And, you know, her name means to be expansive, to be roomy. That may be where you get the idea of being an accommodating person. That's where some were thinking, well, is it really talking about, as some people say, that she was a harlot? Or is it that she was an accommodating person? Now, both ways, you could say, the character of being accommodating and also the character of being despised in society or such also has its interesting connotations for who, doesn't matter where you actually come from in your past, what then do you do about it when the decision is put forward to you? Just like we saw with the 12 back there in Matthew, when they were called, they left what their old way of life was, whether it was fishing or tax collecting, and they said, this is the Lamb of God. So one of the things that we see with her faith in what she had possibly heard about, as we see later on, that the people who were looking for the spies were quite perplexed by the presence of Yisrael nearby, and they were searching them out, fearful that they would take over the city. But Rahab put her trust in the one who took out Sihon and Og on the eastern banks of the Jordan, the Jordan River, and also the one that took out the army of Mitzrayim in the sea some four decades earlier. So when you think about faith, this is a great picture of faith. Interesting thing that Yeshua said about, you know, I have not found such faith even in Israel. And he was talking about the centurion in that case, who was described as a God-fearer, one who was definitely reverent of the God of Israel and realized that, hey, in Yeshua, this was someone who was specially a part of the kingdom of God. And it's like, I'm not even worthy to have someone like that in my midst, but I know that God gives the power, so you don't actually have to show up here. A little bit different from even in the house of Israel, even in among the close friends of Yeshua, when, you know, Lazar died, you know, they were asking, you know, even Miriam asking, well, hey, if you had been here, then he wouldn't have died. So an interesting point also going on further is that Rahab and her deep trust in the Lord was also basically put her into the genealogy of the Mashiach, and something that is talked about by the apostle Yaakov and also the writer of the letter to Hebrews, where the apostle Yaakov writes in James chapter 2, in the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out a different way? For just as the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead. So a very interesting point of, okay, what do you believe? And is that actually moving into your life? And are you actually going to change your life in the process of it? Or is it just something that you do one day a week? And also you see that This is a part of a discussion earlier about Avraham and Avraham's faith. And you see that recorded later on in Hebrews chapter 11, the so-called Hall of Faith passage, where it's specifically talking about Rahab. And it says, "By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. And by faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace." A very interesting thing to note is that when the two spies were saying to her as they were leaving, is like, you know, if you put that red cord out the window outside the wall, but no one in your household leaves that house, otherwise it's on your own head. Well, what does that kind of sound like? It sounds almost like the Pesach, the blood of the Pesach on the door. And as long as you stayed inside the house, then you were protected from the destroyer outside. So interesting here, roughly four decades later after the Pesach, you also have this story here where the destroyer now is Yisrael with the power of God, mainly. This is one that power of God is what knocked down the walls that allowed Yisrael to go inside. But now Israel is also in a sort of a team effort as the Lord's destroyer going through Jericho, and the protection of the Lord was in on that house, but delegated to Israel to see, oh, you see that cord? No one is going to be touched, not by the power of God was shaking down the walls, and not by any of Israel that was going into the city. So very interesting. We see also tradition notes that Rahab married Yehoshua and, you know, led on to descendants like Yemariahu or Jeremiah, and also prophets and priests afterwards. So very interesting message of where do you put your trust, and that trust, that faith in the God of Israel makes you a part of the family. You're grafted in, as Paul puts it there in Romans. So, one of the things, getting back into Numbers, one of the things we see is that in Numbers chapter 14, Israel rebels twice. They rebel not just with saying, okay, believing the bad report of the 10 over the two who were saying, okay, the Lord brought us here, the Lord is going to take care of it. But then later on, after they get the message from the Lord, is like, okay, you reject me, you reject the land I'm taking you to. Okay, now you, first generation, you will go and you will die off. You think you were going to be victim to the giants and their walls? Well, you actually will be victim, but it won't specifically be from the giants or the walls. It's that, you know, the Lord is going to be not allowing you to go in, and you will just die in the desert. And then you also saw in there that the 10 spies who gave the bad report, that they died in a specific plague just for them. But Yehoshua and Caleb were spared from that. So the interesting picture that we see here in Moshe's intercession for the people is you also see this intercession. It's recorded in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 8 through 16, about this great high priest. And that comes after a discussion about that the Lord is the one who gives us rest, and this great rest being encapsulated about the one who brings rest in Yeshua. And that's after a discussion talking about the weekly Shabbat. So hopefully you're starting to see here this connection between rejecting going into the Lord's rest and the Shabbat. So you then might start seeing why it is that the Shabbat is discussed in the midst of a discussion of rebellion of Israel going into the land, going into the Lord's rest. And in chapters 3 and 4, chapter 3 hits it really big with a number of quotations from Psalm 95, verses 7 through 11, about when the Lord said, "I swore in my anger, you shall not enter my rest." And that also connected back when, if you look into Psalm 95, that is drawing a lot from the incident it talked about with Meribah and Massah about rejecting the Lord's provision, which, and that Massah Meribah episode is recorded in Exodus chapter 17, which, if you recall, the presentation of this, it was presented as being following after the crossing of the Red Sea, so a big illustration of God's provision. Then also chapter 16 about the Lord's provision of manna, the daily bread. So this question that comes up in chapter 17 of Exodus, is God with us or not? You should already have your question answered by that point. And likewise, with these people who are being presented the testimony of the 10 spies versus the two, that question of who you could actually trust and whose testimony is trustworthy and what lines up with the evidence that Israel had already seen in the past, that should have already been made clear. So we see that this second generation of going into the land also had to face the same question. And when Yehoshua then took up the mantle from Moshe going into the land to actually enter the Lord's rest, yet there was that lingering mistrust of God. So that question, is the Lord with us or not? We see answered sadly in a rebellion of sorts in what you call syncretism, or blending together the practices and in the land with the worship and knowledge of the one true God. So that was a lesson that continued on, and each generation had to keep asking the question, is the Lord with us or not? And a question we have to ask with us today, is the Lord with us or not? And, you know, the question that the apostles bring out is that, you know, the Lord is not slack in concerning his promises. So, as some might consider slackness. So we might think, oh, well, it's been so long since the time when Yeshua returned to heaven, that is the day of the Lord actually ever going to come? But we can see here with this is that this trust that happens in key generations through time is also with us in this generation. Is following the Lord's instructions really the way to go? Or perhaps, you know, maybe a more novel method that is more egalitarian, such as, you know, talking a lot about socialism these days. Is that the better way of the provision of heaven, is to have everything spread across to everybody? Is that where the true representation of heaven is? Now, we see that in it's recorded in the book of Acts, that after the great Shavuot experience, when they're all gathered together, they had everything in common. Whenever they need something, somebody would sell property. But you see what happens is that with the account there in Acts of Ananias and Sapphira, that if your heart is not actually involved with the giving, then it is taking. And the idea of your free gift is then lost. And then you will want to grab it back, as Ananias and Sapphira did. So that was not a free gift out. They brought something, it says, a portion of the proceeds. And Kepha asked them, is this all of it? And they said, mm-hmm, yes. One said first, yes, it is. And then the sentence came down. You might say, well, that's harsh over just giving an offering. Well, you know, you think the Shabbat commandment is harsh about you know, we'll be getting to this in just a moment about desecrating the Shabbat, that being harsh with the death penalty. But giving an offering with the death penalty? Wow, that's that seems harsh as well. But a similar aspect that we'll see in Acts chapter 15, or the Numbers chapter 15 that's described there with the Shabbat issue with the guy gathering sticks, is also present there with the heart issue involved with Aeneas and Sapphira about bringing the whole offering that they represented it was to be. Because if you give a gift to the Lord, that is not something you, and you say you're giving a gift, but you only bring part of it. It's like, you see later on in the prophets where it's talking about fulfill your vows and also bring the whole tithe into the storehouse. Don't skim off the top of the tithes as some of the priesthood were doing. One of the lessons, kind of closing out this passage here, where the folk in that first generation, after they get the sentence declared to them, hey, now you have to go wander about for 40 years, they say, no, we're going to go up. So, and they get beaten. And you get the indication that it wasn't a large contingent that they went up against, and even a small number of losses, yet they ran and scattered because they thought they were afraid before. Well, if the Lord is not with them, as it mentions there, the ark didn't move and Moshe didn't move. So they were on their own going up. So one of the things that we see is that, you know, when God tells us no, we actually should listen to that. And also, we see that with that whipping, that on their own, they couldn't even take care of a small contingent of the land, not even the Anakim nor the folk actually in their big walls. So thinking about the challenge of going up against the walls by themselves, yeah, flesh and bone, not able to actually take care of this challenge, especially in their weakened state. Now on to chapter 15 as we, you know, round things out here today. And Numbers 15, it starts out talking about offerings. It's like, well, okay, well, we've seen this already in Leviticus. So what is the discussion here? Well, building on the theme that we've talked about the outpouring of the heart, a lot of, you keep seeing that passage brought up, you know, about having a vow that you want to fulfill. You know, vows are voluntary. And then it also talks about covering for unintentional sins. And it keeps repeating this theme over and over again. It was an error. It was an error. But not glossing over the fact that later on about the high-handed sins, and specifically, we'll be looking at this issue of the sky gathering sticks on Shabbat. And you're like, well, is Sabbath breaking really that wrong that God would have said, okay, this is a death penalty offense? And there was a meme that was going around about 20 or so years ago, now even made it onto TV, where you had the aspect of, well, if I see my neighbor mowing his lawn on the Sabbath, do I go over and kill him? Well, no, because number one, you're talking about the idea of a vigilante. Then you're talking about, well, who's you're going to bring your case to? On and on and on it goes. It's very similar to what was wrong with Yeshua's trial before the Sanhedrin. Very similar ideas of what you're taking it to. Then, for some reason, you might ask, why is the idea of the tassels brought up in chapter 15 after this thing talking about Shabbat breaking? What's up with the tassels? So, continuing on with this, just a recap of some of the measurements in there. An ephod, roughly 6 gallons. A hin is roughly a gallon. A quarter hin is roughly a quart. So with this drink offering, it's very interesting that you'll see in a couple of aspects with Yeshua and the Apostle Paul, both talked in imagery of a drink offering. For example, you know, the Luke 22 there during the Pesach, where he says, this cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood. Well, there's a whole lot in that aspect about the new covenant and the blood of the Mashiach, but this idea of like the drink offering being poured out gives you a slight window into what the drink offerings were all about. And because this picture of life in the blood and where there were the aspects of that you were to pour out the blood of certain offerings. So you see this picture of in Mark chapter 14, verse 24, Yeshua says that this is blood poured out for many, and Matthew 26 includes the aspect that this is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. So this, the new covenant, which goes back to what was prophesied in Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 through 34, that this covenant, the new covenant, that he would write his laws upon our hearts and upon our minds, and also the aspect, so they got the one aspect, writing his laws upon our hearts, so coming out from within us, wanting to do the Lord's work, similar to what Yeshua said, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. So that picture there. Number two, the aspect, well, everyone will know the Lord. Everyone will know the Lord. Well, the repercussions of the new covenant in my blood have gone worldwide from all of the apostles and other sent ones. The message have of that has gone out around the world. And also, the last aspect that's mentioned in Jeremiah chapter 31 is that I will remember their iniquity no more. So that forgiveness of sins, that being poured out for many, that aspect of covering the sins and remembering them no more, and not just remembering their iniquities no more, because if you remember our discussion from Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, that you have the three things that are covered. It's called Yom HaKippurim, the day of coverings. The three things that are covered there is the sins, the transgressions, and the iniquities. And they are the kind of the increasing level of, you could say, rebellion or moving away from what the Lord's path is. You know, the sins being similar to what's talked about there in Numbers 15. You know, it was an error. Then transgressions, a little bit more willful in your going against the Lord, and iniquities is like you are all out on your own, going in the direction of treason against heaven. So one of the aspects that you see here is that, and as the Apostle Paul captures it in Romans chapter 12, where it talks about be a living sacrifice. This is what the Torah is in action, not something that's just kept to a building or to a tent in the case of the tabernacle. And when the tent or the tabernacle is not there, then it's like, that doesn't apply to your life. It is what is the lesson of each of these offerings, as we talked about with the book of Vayikra or Leviticus, that the korban, the offering, is the thing that approaches. And we are to want to approach, the people are, as a whole, should want to approach the Lord's presence. So how is that translated into daily life? How is our daily life being, we're living our life where we are wanting to be closer to the Lord, but also wanting our actions to be moving toward the Lord in the same case. So we'll be hitting a little bit more on this as we get further on into our discussion. So about the section there, Numbers chapter 15, verses 32-36, where it's talking about the Shabbat breaker is executed. So just various ideas on what was actually happening here. Some would say this was a violation because he was preparing to kindle a fire, and kindling a fire was forbidden on Shabbat. Some say that he was harvesting or carrying. Some even will say what it's talked about, not sticks, but could refer also to logs. So this was a little bit more involved than just stooping over to pick up sticks, but it could be some pretty significant amount of timber work going on here. And, you know, there's also the possibility that this is something following after Numbers 14, as we've talked about a bit earlier in the book of Bamidbar. It's not actually arranged totally chronologically, but thematically. So, you know, perhaps it's put here because of the theme of devotion, the front part of chapter 15, and also sandwiched in the middle of rebellion, and similar to what you have in chapter 14 about rebelling against the going into the Lord. So, some ideas that people have come up with over time, but just actually going back a little bit to the idea of the Shabbat breaker, is what is the actual passage there in verses 30 and 31? That is, you know, just like with Yeshua's parables, they have a punchline. Well, the punchline of this particular passage is in verses 30 and 31, where it says that the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is a native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from his people, because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment. That person shall be completely cut off. His guilt will be upon him. So some key things to think about in here is defiantly, blaspheming, and despised. That you're getting to the heart of the issue of what this situation, why it was so, say, egregious, so bad, so in your face toward the God of heaven and earth, was defiantly, it's specifically mentioned as being with a high hand, and also with blaspheming the Lord. Now, that's interesting. You're thinking of acting with a high hand and blaspheming the Lord. So how then is acting defiantly blaspheming the Lord? We saw earlier with what Moshe said near the, it's recorded at the end of Numbers 14, where he's basically proclaiming the name of the Lord back to the Lord, talking about his loving kindness, what was presented to Moshe when Moshe was revealed the glory. He asked to see the glory of God and was allowed to see at least the back or a portion of the glory of God. But the proclaiming of the name, a portion of that is about, you know, loving kindness, devotion, loyalty in here. So Moshe quoting that back about loyalty, and also saying, well, if you do this and you wipe out all of these people, well, what then will the nation say? That you took the people out of the house of bondage, you humiliated a superpower in the process, yet you're not able to actually bring them in there. Well, what is the issue? The issue is the heart of the people. The heart of the people had to change. And another lesson is that just like with Yehoshua and Caleb and the younger people under 20 who were a part of this, they had to suffer along with the older generation in being outside of the land. It wasn't their fault. They weren't involved with the decision. And with Caleb and Yehoshua, they campaigned against that decision. But still, they went through it as well. So a good lesson for us. We may not understand why it is that we're going through a situation. And like, well, we're not responsible for this. But still, the part that is included in there is what to endure, to go through, as Yeshua was telling the 12 that he was sending out. You know, the one who endures to the end will be saved. You see the similar thing in the book of Revelation as well. He who endures to the end will be saved. So it doesn't matter if you're responsible or not. How do you behave? As we read earlier from the Apostle Yaakov, you know, you can have claim your faith, all this and that and the other, but if it doesn't show up in your life, that you move forward, even if it looks like your whole life is pointless, but what actually is your life headed toward? You think your legacy is going to endure heading away from God? I do what I want and nothing results from it. But is that way going to endure? Well, you have to assume that there is no God and that the ways of this earth are never, ever going to be brought to an end, as it's recorded there in Isaiah 66 and Revelation 21, 22. So you have to assume that. Well, what if that's not actual reality? So the one who has faith perseveres forward, even so you say you're throwing your life away following the kingdom of God. You're not rich, you're not powerful, you're not going after the things of this world that are fun for the moment. Well, what legacy are you building? You know, you have the choice. You can choose the things that are for the here, for the now, to not have a legacy, or you can choose for the things that actually will stretch on later on in life and for the generations that follow, something that goes down from generation to generation. What do we want to be remembered for? So with that, kind of rounding things out with the, what's the whole idea about these tassels? And you're like, why is this showing up here at the end of this particular passage? So I think kind of thematically, we've got the beginning part of scoping out the land, the putting your faith into action, putting your faith into works there for those 12 tribes, sending out their leaders to go look at the land. Are they going to follow along with the one who's taken them this far, or are they going to rebel against him? So you then have the presentation here of these tassels, or as it tzitzit, singular, tzitzitot for plural, which, and you look at the Septuagint, it's translated into Greek there as kraspedon, and kraspedon is exactly what you see. Is the word that's mentioned there with what people were grabbing, where there was the woman who was bleeding for 12 years, recorded in Matthew chapter 9. When she was healed, she grasped the kraspeton of his garment, and she was healed. And you also see in Matthew chapter 14 that there were crowds that sought healing by reaching and touching his tzitzit, his kraspeton. So, why would anybody expect that there would be healing to come through this? And one of the messianic prophecies that's been known for a long time is in Malachi chapter 4, verse 2, where it talks about, "But you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings, and you will go forth and skip about like calves from the stall." And wings, there is, you have the word of kanaf, and kanaf is, as we go back into Numbers chapter 15, it talks about that you will have a tzitzitot on the kanaf of your garments, or the corners, the wings of your garments. So this picture came down, the expectation of a messianic figure, the Messiah, would be the tzitzit were a great symbols of the healing power of the Mashiach. So you're like, well, that's very interesting. Then you see this connection, and people were having the expectation that the tzitzit were a reaching and grabbing hold, which is what you see in recorded in a Day of the Lord prophecy in Zechariah chapter 4, where people will be desperate to know what to do, desperate to know who God is. And they will grab, it says, to grab on to the tzitzitot of one Jew, because they said, we've heard that God's with you. Very similar to what you see in the New Covenant prophecy back in Jeremiah chapter 31, where people are like, the knowledge of the Lord will be a key part of the outpouring of the Spirit of God into the world. So, as we close out here today, just close out with Isaiah chapter 6, because this gets to an aspect of the heart message that's really at the heart of Yehoshua and Caleb and their, you could say, the great president, the great Nasis, the great leaders of their tribes to lead them forward. And not coincidentally, who do you see show up in the later history of Israel and also in prophecies? You see Yehuda and Ephraim. Very interesting, the house of Yehuda and the house of Ephraim. Now, it turns out in the history of Israel, those two tribes ended up being, you could say, the center points for the divided kingdom, north and south. But you also see a tension that they are depicted as also the whole house of Israel, of the Yehuda and Ephraim. So, little picture here in chapter 6 gives the historical context. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, lofty and exalted, with his train of his robe filling the temple. The seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out while the temple was filling with smoke. But then I said, "Woe is me, I'm ruined because I'm a man of unclean lips and I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." And one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. He touched my mouth with it and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here I am, send me." He said, "Go tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive and their ears dull and their eyes dim. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed." Then I said, "Lord, how long?" And he answered, "Until cities are devastated and without inhabitant, houses are without people, and the land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the district of the land. Yet there will be a tenth portion in it, and it will again be a subject to burning, like a terebinth of an oak whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump." So, you see a number of things in this particular passage, one of which is Yeshua himself quoted as he was talking about, well, why is it that you are talking in parables? And here is specifically why. So it was saying for the generation before that great exiles there of Assyria and Babylon is something that would be for the exile or the desolation, the abomination of desolation there, after the time of Yeshua in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed. Very similar situation. So you're like, again, you're wondering, is this like with the 12 spies, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Is this just setting people up to fail if you are just speaking to them in parables and otherwise that they would see and turn around? It seems like, wow, that's kind of harsh. But again, it gets to the heart of, do you want to see? Do you actually want to hear? Do you? And those who actually wanted to understand, even as, you know, we might say, oh, some of the 12 were kind of dense, but they wanted to know. So we too, you know, we may feel that we're just dense. We're not getting it. We're, We're just totally clueless. But do we actually want to know? Do we actually want to be sent? So as a question for us today, and that's, we'll leave things there. Any last thoughts as we close out? You can unmute yourself if you have a question or a comment.
Well, I was surprised in the next parashat that they actually did the same thing when they went into Jericho. Joshua sent them out to spy and used almost the same words.
Yep. It's almost like there's a similar thing that keeps happening over time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Similar.
I'm surprised that Joshua had anything to do with that because he was so faithful.
Mm-hmm. Well, the issue is that what then is the message of sending out the spies? Is it for the ones sending them out, or is it for everybody else? Which, you know, is what a lot of folk have struggled with over time of the sending out of the 12 spies. Was that just setting them up to fail? Or was that to help them with their faith, their trust in the Lord, the one who took them there?
What a good lesson for us, at least.
You betcha it is. That's why
I think Numbers doesn't mention that it was their idea first. In Numbers, it sounded like it was God's idea.
Yes. Yes. It talks about that the Lord did that. Well, you could say also the Lord put the tree in the garden.
Yeah.
So what then do you do? What then do you do about that?
Free will, I guess.
It is free will, but it is also about learning and also observing what is really happening inside of you. Where
that's scary.
Yes, it is extremely scary. And that is the point of the parables and the such, is that it's not spoon-fed to you. Do you really want to know? You know, when one of the scariest psalms is that, you know, Lord, reveal everything about me, search me out. Because, wow. And it's like, and then lead me into the paths of everlasting. Well, do you actually want to go on that path?
Well, when I get to that point, I always say, and fix it quick before I get the chance to think about it.
Yeah. Yes, Anne.
Question is, where it's said in Matthew about he who follows me must pick up his cross and follow me. Now, the word cross, is that different in the Hebrew, or is that, you know, a typical Christian type of cross?
Yes. Pick up the point of sentencing that sends you to death. In that case, it's represented there as the execution stake, however you want to render that. But it is that which you are being sent to as a sentence. Now, in a sense, you could say, what is the context of the passage? It's saying people are going to drag you into the synagogues. They're going to drag you before courts. It's not talking about just becoming a pill within your own family so that all your family hates you. Is that if you are following along with the Lord's way, a lot of people are just not going to agree with you. You see it today. You pipe up things about the way of God, and people will laugh at you. They'll unfriend you, and on and on and on it goes. They'll just hate you. It's not that some people do that to themselves by their behavior, but then there's also they don't want to hear it. They don't want the message. They'll just tune you out, whether it's in your family or your quote friends or coworkers, whatever it is, they'll just tune you out. Same thing happened with Yeshua. Yeah, it was for our benefit that the Lord crushed him, but there was also the aspect that you have the prophecy given to Caiaphas that, hey, one man has to die for the sake of the nation. So in the smaller sense of in our families, hey, this guy, this gal has got to go. We got to get rid of him. Whatever our cross, our execution stake is, both either socially or literally, because we see that happen to our brothers and sisters around the world too, is that they're literally facing execution stakes, execution swords, execution bullets, on and on, on and on it goes. So whatever that is, embrace it. You know, not like you're part of some death cult, but just say, which way would you rather go? Would you rather be like Caleb and Yehoshua and just say, hey, the road is tough. It looks like I'm facing death. I don't care. The Lord says, go forward, and I trust him.
Very good. Onward.
Yes. So the same thing that was said to Avraham can be said to us. Lech lecha, get going.
Thank you.
Yes, Rose.
Yeah, my question is about the number 10 mentioned. You know, you got your 10 plagues, you got your 10 murmurs, your 10 commandments. Is there a specific meaning for the number 10?
A lot of people think that it's, well, in the places where you see it show up about either a judgment or a set of standards, a path. So with that, you see 10, their judgment came down. They made a judgment into which way they wanted to go. And that took the whole people with them.
Well, that makes sense. When you think about the 10 plagues, you know, every time the Pharaoh decided not to let them go, they got a plague. So, and then the 10 murmurs, you know, they were all killed. So, yeah, I can see that would be judgment.
Yeah. So that's why with numbers, you can just see what is the context they're showing up to get some sort of a hint as to what the lesson is. That's what I was saying earlier about 7. When you see it show up, it's a related word of Shavua being an oath, also connected with an oath. But then you also see it's connected with 7 and the totality of creation, especially. So you see, hey, that was brought to a point of completion. So thus you also see 7 show up a lot in Daniel's prophecies as well. So
numbers are very significant to God.
The ones that you keep seeing show up on a regular occasion, you should take notice. We will close out with prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us the testimony of your servants, and we just ask that you give us boldness, that in the ways that you've sent us to go, that we go. And we just ask for wisdom to follow your leading and to not fight against you. We just ask that you continue to mold us and to shape us, to be willing to be corrected, and to be willing to be a part of your message, to be your delegates, your ambassadors in the world. We thank you for these things. In the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.